The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Well, welcome. My name is Ryan Evans. I'm the headmaster at Providence Classical Christian School in Kirkland, Washington. So I'm well used to the rain. In fact, I don't know that I've ever been as wet as how wet I got today outside. And believe it or not, yeah, I'm from Seattle, too. I spent 14 years in administration and a little over 20 in Christian education. It's been a blessing to my wife and I to see our oldest graduate from our school this year. And for those who have had that privilege of seeing a kid, a son or daughter, go from K through 12, what a great experience. It's just a huge blessing. And for those just maybe starting or if you have little kids, it is so worth the journey. And isn't it great to see our kids outperform us? I mean, that is that's great. Well, my presentation is basically on books that every school leader should read. It sounds a little bit overly dogmatic, perhaps, but I'm here to just recommend books. Hopefully you are a book person already, but hopefully you can at least take something away from this workshop. I'm sure I will mention some books that you've already read, but hopefully there will be some new ones on the list as well. There's so much out there to read and so much good stuff, and like me, I'm sure you have limited time. And so choosing the right kinds of books is important. How many board members do we have in this room? Just raise your hand if you're a board member. Okay, great. And then administrators? Okay, so mostly administrators. Great. That's good to have both. So what qualifies me for this? Well, one is I think just my experience in Christian education and leadership. But the other thing is I just love to read. And so I try to read a lot of stuff, and I like reading footnotes because I get other book recommendations as you look at footnotes. And so that's the kind of reader I am. But I also understand there are probably people here who are much more widely read. And so if you have time, which I really doubt, I would love to have that conversation or maybe stick around and talk to me. I'd love to hear recommendations that you have as well. About 10 years ago on Mars Hill Audio, Ken Myers had a guest named Dana Gioia. Dana Gioia at the time was the chairman for the National Endowment of the Arts, and the NEA had concluded a study that they had done on reading trends among young people. And if you heard that episode, you probably remember that the reading trends were pretty ominous. Their reading is falling, and hopefully our schools are recovering that, and I think we all play a fairly significant part in that. He actually, Dana Gioia cited a study done on these trends. And he cited a study that I found really interesting. They found three main components that help grow readers. And the first one is pretty obvious. If you read to your children, that helps them become readers. We all know that. The second one was a little less obvious, and that is if you prioritize as a parent reading to such an extent that there are times where you tell your son or daughter, you know what, go find something else to do, I'm reading. If you make it a priority, that actually has a pretty significant impact. But the third thing was even more interesting. The third thing they found was that readers, by and large, there was a direct correlation between whether or not you were a reader and how many books were in your home. Physical presence of books. It said it crossed racial boundaries, it crossed socioeconomic boundaries. So just the presence of having books in your house and in your school, I think is pretty significant. In fact, listen to this quote from C.S. Lewis in his book, Surprised by Joy. Lewis says, "My father bought all the books he read and never got rid of any of them. There were books in the study, books in the drawing room, books in the cloakroom. Books in the cloakroom, books too deep in the great bookcase in the landing, books in the bedroom, books piled high as my shoulder in the cistern attic, books of all kinds reflecting every transient stage of my parents' interests, books readable and books unreadable, books suitable for a child, and books most emphatically not." That's from Lewis. So we'll cover just some books that I will recommend. It's not an exhaustive list. There are tons of others, and it was really hard to just pare it down to 12, but that's what I attempted to do. So there are four themes here, and that should be in your outline: worldview, leadership, Christian education, and classical education. So the first book that I'm going to just dive into, just because of time, is Nancy Percy's Total Truth. How many people have read Nancy Percy's Total Truth? So a lot of people already. She just came out with another one. I think, is it called Finding Truth, I believe? Something like that. But it's brand new, and we may have that on the book table. But I didn't choose this just because she's going to be speaking at this conference. I was overwhelmed when I read this book. She has written several other books before this one, but this one is sort of one of those all-encompassing books. It includes history and cultural criticism and science and theology and ethics and philosophy, even business. Percy was a student of Francis Schaeffer. She went to LaBrie, and that's where she, I think, really was converted and had a lot of her questions answered there. In this book, what she does, and if you've read Schaeffer, you probably understand Percy too, but she talks about those two stories, the upper story, the lower story, the values versus facts, upper and lower, private versus public. And her basic point is, we have so compartmentalized our faith, we have so compartmentalized our belief, that we don't even think as full-orbed Christians. And she gives a lot of examples, you know, politicians who say they're personally against abortion, yet do nothing about it. As we raise our children, she says, we watch the world's movies, listen to the same music, and we expect very different outcomes. In business, she says, we employ the same strategies as everyone else, even if they're based on social or psychological manipulation. So she's got these great examples. How many times have you spoken with a person who, maybe it's about schooling, and they send their kids to Christians that send their kids to public schools, but they say they see no dichotomy. They just sort of offer up this neutrality. In fact, the first time I read Nancy Piercy's Total Truth, I talked with some of the faculty members at my school about it, and it wasn't less than 2 weeks. We were at a chapel, and the chapel director of the chapel literally said to the kids exactly what Piercy is saying the opposite of. And she said to the students, she said, chapel is for the heart. Your classes are for the head. Chapel is for the heart. And so she's literally, this leader is literally sort of causing this compartmentalizing of these students' faith. And so I recommended Total Truth to her. Again, sake of time, I'm going to keep moving on, but Total Truth is a great book. I'm going to give one quote from Nancy Percy. The only way to stand against a comprehensive naturalistic worldview, as Abraham Kuyper said, is by articulating a Christian worldview of equally comprehensive and far-reaching power. We must prepare young people before they leave for college by teaching them that Christianity is not just religious truth, but the truth about all reality. At our school, we actually have our seniors in their apologetics class read a lot from Total Truth, and they've really benefited from it. Obviously, lots of great books to include in the section of worldview development. I almost put Harry Blumeyer's The Christian Mind in here, but I ended up choosing James K. A. Smith's Designing the Kingdom, partly because it has so many implications for education. The subtitle is Worship, Worldview, and Cultural Formation. I should say, as a disclaimer, you know, all these books have their faults. There's no perfect book, and so there might be some things you disagree with Smith about here. But his concern is that the term Christian worldview tends to fall short in our schools. He's really about not just cultivating the mind, which is what I think particularly ACCS schools are good at doing, but I think ACCS schools are also really good about cultivating that heart. Not to separate those things, but there's a dichotomy sometimes in schools where it's so academic focused that we forget it's about enculturation. It's about character formation. And Smith offers great questions in his book. What vision of human flourishing is implicit in this or that practice? He talks a lot about liturgies, rituals, forms. What does the good life look like as embedded in cultural rituals? What sort of person will I become after being immersed in this or that cultural liturgy? What is the telos of this practice or that practice? So, again, the enculturation aspect applies to schools. In fact, I can remember a time we had a visitor in our school, and we were at that time in a very tight building, so you had all the kids that were together, and I had this sub, it was a substitute applicant. I was running late. She was waiting out for probably 10 minutes just observing our students. And I went to get her, and I apologized for being late, brought her into my office, and she had this shocked look on her face. And I said, "Is everything okay?" And she said, "I'm shocked. I'm amazed at your students." And I said, "What do you mean?" Well, she proceeded to talk really about the hidden curriculum, as it said. She said, the way the students speak to each other, the way the faculty speak to them, the way the older kids treat the younger kids, just the manners of the students, that's really what Smith is talking about. And so I highly recommend this book because it helps us frame what we're doing in our schools in a much bigger picture than sometimes we get in education. It's not just about academics or college prep. It's about the forming of the whole person. Okay, moving on to let's get to one quote before we move on to the next section. Smith says, "Being a disciple of Jesus is not primarily a matter of getting the right ideas and doctrines and beliefs in your head in order to guarantee proper behavior. Rather, it's a matter of being the kind of person who loves rightly, who loves God and neighbor, and is oriented to the world by the primacy of that love." He gets a little philosophical at times, and you may be a person that loves that or doesn't, but he gives a lot of practical advice in his book, Desiring the Kingdom, as well. Okay, moving on to boards. The first book, how many people have read Serving God on the Christian School Board? Okay, so just a few. It's an ACSI, book published by ACSI, and we give it to every board member who starts at our school. It's about 100 pages. It's very readable, very accessible, written by Roy Lowry Jr. and Roy Lowry. Simple, short book, easy read, but serves as a great introduction to Christian school boards. The thing I love about this book is it's specifically for Christian schools. And so they talk a lot about some of the practices such as board decision making and the commitment that board members are required to make. But they also talk about things like gossip and Matthew 18 and the value of a praying board. And so this one is one of those that I think is a must read for board members, not so much maybe as administrators, but that's helpful too. A few main highlights about this one. Talks a lot about qualifications, and these guys say the qualifications for a board member should be analogous to elder qualifications. They talk about the governance model, proper governance model, the role of the board vis-a-vis the role of the administrator, and we'll get to that in a minute too with the next book. Let's go to a quote here. Oops, sorry. Oops, there's no quote. Let me read you a quote instead. Sensitivity, if you're a board member, you know how that works, the sensitivity. You're talking as a board, what leaves the boardroom, what doesn't leave the boardroom. And they say, "The board entrusts the administrator with much confidential information. Even a spouse should not know some things, lest they upset the spouse or cause him or her to be uneasy when around the people involved." I don't know if you've seen that before, but I've observed that, and I think it's something that you really have to be careful about, but one of the reasons I love this book, they get into those specific issues as they pertain to Christian school boards. Next book is by John Carver, Boards That Make a Difference. This is probably by far the most boring book on this list. Not easy to get through. It's a business-type, model-type book, but extremely helpful in terms of establishing proper relationships. I think you can buy this on Amazon. In fact, we bought all these for our board. I think they're a penny on Amazon, so you can get this book really cheap, used version, of course. Carver's main point is that boards should create a general policy manual that accurately reflects the organization's mission. So I want to check that out. Thank you. Nicely done. Well done. He says, the CEO or the president or the head of school, headmaster, should make the decisions ranging from personnel to finance to programs. The board should fundamentally address core values and vision. And so what you're doing, the boards are drawing this box, and the administrator works within that box. Boards have one sole employee. So boards, Carver talks about what do boards do that, what things do they do that really ought to be avoided? Well, spending too much time on the trivial, having a short-term emphasis, being reactive as opposed to proactive. He says reviewing, rehashing, and redoing. If you've been in board meetings before, and we've had our issues at our board, but this one kind of transformed our board as we moved more into a Carver model, spend a lot less time on the day-to-day stuff and more time looking ahead. So the board should advance the vision. They should address fundamental values, focus on the externals, enable an outcome-driven education. The only weakness probably in this one is that it's all-encompassing, so it's boards mostly nonprofits, but it's for multiple ministries. It's not just schools. So combining this one with the Lowry book, I think, is particularly helpful. I think I have a quote for this one. No? Didn't realize we were on a construction site. Yeah, I'll take it that way. Carver says the board has three core, what he calls, products. A linkage to ownership, explicit governing policies, and that's where the policy manual comes in, and the assurance of executive performance. So really what the board does is the board draws that box, and then they supervise their one employee, the head. When I first came to our school, I had known some of the board members and known some of some people in the school, and I knew that the board was having weekly meetings, long meetings, and as I came and interviewed, I said, you know, that's not what I'm interested in. I said, why are you guys doing that? And they basically said, well, because we had to. In other words, if the administration isn't doing its job, then the board has to overstep, and nobody wins in that. Everybody loses. This next book is, I'm guessing, probably new to most of you because it was just recently published. It's called Building a Better School, and the authors are Timothy and Catherine Weems, I think, or is that right, Weems? Do you know this book?
I don't know this book, but I know the name.
Know the name, great. So, wonderful book. It has about 14 different essays written by different authors on different topics, but particularly for boards and administrators, this is really helpful. The first half of the book, the essays focus mostly on issues that pertain to boards. In fact, our board just started reading through this. We're on, I think, chapter 2. Bruce Lockerbie, whose name probably some of you recognize, is published by Payday Press, which Bruce Lockerbie is involved in. And Bruce actually wrote the first chapter of this book called Christian Schooling, Essential and Beneficial. And Bruce just outlines why are Christian schools so important and essential. And I think sometimes in the business, the day-to-day business, we forget what business we're in. And so reminders like essays from Bruce Lockerbie are very helpful. There's another super helpful chapter called School Distinctives and Why It Matters. They talk about the difference between climate and culture and ethos and character in a school. Those all sound the same, but the author actually defines those differently, and I found that particularly helpful. The need for change. There's a chapter on the need for change in American Christian schools, a chapter on the mission of schools, a chapter on the head's role as being pastoral, which in Christian schools it certainly is. And there's a great chapter on assessment. So there's one chapter on assessment we've actually shared in an in-service at our school, talking about the difference between formative, for example, and summative testing. Our teachers found that very helpful. So highly recommended. Let me see if I have a quote for that one. I don't. Maybe I grabbed the wrong one, but that's okay. That was God's providence because we're short on time, and so I'm kind of getting through these a little faster than I intended. Okay, so those are the three books on leadership and governance. The next book is really a series of essays and speeches by a theologian, J. Gresham Machen. Machen was a first-class scholar and theologian. He wrote these in the 20s and the 30s, or delivered these, as it were, in the 20s and 30s. He was a professor at Princeton Seminary, and he left due to the liberalism that was creeping into the school and formed Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. Machen is probably best known more for his theological works. If you've ever read Christianity and Liberalism, an incredible book and prophetic. If you read that, I think it was written in 29. And if you read it today, you think he'd written it last year. He saw what was coming. Machen was one of those prophets. He saw what was coming. He also wrote a Greek text that is still a teacher of Greek. And some people, some schools, in fact, our school has actually used Machen's Greek text. It's still used today. But Machen was concerned primarily about the role of the state in education, as well as the role of, that anti-intellectualism was playing in not only in the Christian church, but obviously in schools. One of the chapters records his dialogue before a U.S. Senate committee. This was 1929, where he testified against the proposed creation of the Federal Department of Education. Of course, that happened. But to see Machen developing his thinking is kind of stunning, and again, kind of prescient when you think about where we are today. He has a chapter on faith and knowledge. He has a chapter on the importance of Christian scholarship, Christianity and culture, reforming of the government schools, the necessity of the Christian school. And he has one chapter called the Christian School, the Hope of America. Again, this was in the 20s and 30s when Machen was writing and speaking. But he got it. He understood what we were about. And you can't read Machen without thinking, where are the people like Machen today? And maybe we have some in this room, but I can think of some pastors who I've heard that actually speak on the topic of education. But we need more. I love a couple quotes from Machen because I don't have those here. So a couple quotes that I just wanted to read. Listen to this from Machen. Place the lives of children in their formative years, despite the convictions of their parents, under the intimate control of experts appointed by the state. Force them to attend schools where the higher aspirations of humanity are crushed out and where the mind is filled with the materialism of the day, and it's difficult to see how even the remnants of liberty can subsist. So powerful, powerful theological and philosophical stuff from Machen. So this one is probably right at the top of my list in terms of what I would recommend, because he has a full orb picture and it was written quite a while ago. Ray Grant, you read Abolition of Man by Lewis. I figured probably most people have read this, so I'll go through this one fairly quickly. Lewis, in this book, it's less than 100 pages. We had our faculty read it, and I heard everything from, wow, one of the best books I've ever read, to have no idea what he's talking about. And Lewis can kind of have that effect sometimes. But I had our DOI kind of go through the discussion, and if you have the right kind of person walking through this book, it's super helpful. Lewis's main point is that morality is God-given, that all truth is universal, absolute, and cross-cultural. He uses the Buddhist word, the Tao, T-A-O, to describe a universal ethic that basically all cultures hold. And so he even cites in his appendix Greek, Roman, Chinese, Native American, Norse, Hindu, Egyptian, all these systems that have had certain guidelines that all point to sort of a natural, universal truth. He's not arguing for the truth of the scriptures. He does elsewhere. He believes, obviously, in Jesus Christ, but that's not the point of Abolition of Man. Lewis says the little human animal will not at first have the right responses. Doesn't that sound like Lewis, the little human animal? It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. Again, not arguing for theism, but he's appealing to all cultures that we innately know certain things. He's arguing for a moral education. And to contrast what Lewis says against, say, a statist or government education makes us better understand kind of what we're up against. His most famous quote from Lewis is where he talks about virtue. He talks about the importance of teaching virtue. And he says, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. And so Lewis saw that contrast as well. Again, a lot of people have said this, but Lewis was
was quite the prophet as well.
The next book is a book that's published by ISI. ISI stands for Intercollegiate Studies Institute. And if you're not familiar with ISI, I encourage you. They've actually had a booth at ACCS before. I haven't seen them in the last couple of years, but ISI has great stuff. They have books on politics and literature and history, culture, religion, economics, philosophy. Again, ISI, Intercollegiate Studies Institute. This book is by a guy named Henry T. Edmondson. Edmondson has also written some critiques on Flannery O'Connor, very erudite thinker. But John Dewey and the Decline of American Education, powerful book on progressive education. And a lot of us, we've heard of Dewey, we maybe haven't studied Dewey, but what Edmondson does is he outlines Dewey's influence on what we even see today. And here are some things that he identifies. So what has Dewey done? What has his impact been? Well, one, we've moved away from objective truth and standards toward a student-centered approach to learning that emphasizes experience, feeling, social interaction. School for Dewey was more about socialization than it was about education. He wasn't a big fan of books and certainly wasn't a fan of religion. I went through a teacher training program. I remember going to a public school district, and the superintendent stood up and was talking to all of the students who were going through this education program. And the superintendent said, you know, everything we do at our district, everything our teachers do, is based on a constructivist philosophy, which kind of flows out of progressivism. And if you know anything about constructivism, it basically means that students are constructing their own reality. And think about how that contrasts to how we are trying to educate our kids in terms of, you know, the truth of the scriptures. Truth flows from somewhere. It's not individually determined. Dewey was, like I said, anti-religion. He thought that human nature was good and that students, if properly managed, would delight in their learning. And again, there might be some truth to some of these things, but Dewey was anti-tradition. Classical education and the liberal arts, including classics and the languages, had no use for Dewey. Here's a quote from Edmondson. Like the prodigal son, the educational establishment in this country has wandered from its inheritance. The inheritance comes from ancient Greece through the Judeo-Christian tradition and the best of Enlightenment thought, especially the ideas of the nation's founders. Dewey had no regard for that. Obviously, hands-on knowledge, vocational education with a priority, that was the core of Dewey. He's basically a socialist, and you see that in the kind of education that he advocated. I'm going to close with one more quote from Edmondson, because Edmondson is, a classicist in his own right. He doesn't talk about classical education per se, but would advocate for it. And here's what he says. We must reaffirm the canon of learning. Dewey's influence is evident not only in controversies over the subject matter of education, but also in the denial of the possibility of any authoritative subject matter. The educational establishment has in large measure accepted the position that no material is important enough to command our respect and enjoy a fixed status in learning. Again, antithetical to a classical approach. The next book is probably the hardest, in my opinion, the toughest to digest and work through. That's just me as a reader. It's also the most expensive book. You'll be lucky to find that for anything less, Norms of Nobility, for anything less than $40. I think I've read it a couple times at least, and I learn a lot of new things every time I read David Hicks's Norms of Nobility. Hicks is what some consider, and I'll talk more about that later, an advocate for what he calls moral classicism, or what some call moral classicism. It's an approach to classical education that is in pursuit of the ideal type. Hicks, a lot of times, will use the question from Plato, can virtue be taught, as a springboard for his approach to classical education. There's a lot we share, I think, if you read Hicks and Norms of Nobility with ACCS schools, but it does have slightly a different connotation. Quote from Hicks: to hold that virtue can be taught and that it is the chief duty of the school to teach it need not imply a belief in the perfectibility of man. Rather, it implies a belief in the ideal of virtue as well as in the value of an education based upon the attempt to know and to emulate the ideal. So he's a lot about pursuing the ideal type. Hicks is a Christian. He does talk about a Christian paideia. But we would say, you know, the ideal type obviously is found in Christ. And if you look at what Hicks recommends, it's almost overwhelming when you look at the curriculum. How many people have read Norms of Nobility? Raise your hand if you've read Norms of Nobility. I don't know about you, but I was kind of intimidated as I read through his the curriculum that they have at his school. I think they divide, he would recommend dividing a curriculum into three parts: the School of Maths and Sciences, which would begin in grade 7, and the School of Arts and Languages, and then the Humane Letters. And really, for Hicks, all of education is predicated on the teacher. It's all about the type of teacher. And I think the challenge with what he advocates is you've really got to have a Renaissance type of person be able to teach in an approach that Hicks recommends. But lots of great things to say. He's pretty prescriptive in terms of his curriculum, but he has a lot of great assumptions. Liberal education takes precedence over vocational training. Amen to that. Better to do a few subjects done well than lots done with mediocrity. Basic skills and ideas should be introduced when children are very young. Any subject can be taught to any student at any level. The student-teacher relationship is critical. In fact, Hicks, despite his very philosophical mindset, has really practical tips for teachers as well, which I love. Wisdom and Eloquence is the next book, and I'm guessing a lot of people have read that one. Charles Evans and Robert Littlejohn, they say the purpose of classical education is twofold. One, to see our students grow spiritually, intellectually, and socially, and two, see them foster that same growth in society. So these guys really understand the connection between thinking and acting. Strengths of this book, tons of them, really comprehensive. They get into really details of grammar school and logic and curriculum and teacher education, integration of the Bible into subjects, the emphasis on character development. They talk about whether or not classical schools should have an AP curriculum. I don't know if your schools do or not, but they speak to that and have some wisdom about schools that are looking at considering that. They advocate a final senior thesis as the capstone experience. And they have a great chapter on the kind of teachers that we're all looking for. One caveat with Littlejohn and Evans, they do take a different approach than ACCS in terms of the interpretation of Dorothy Sayers and her essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. They say, "We flatly deny that there is any historical precedent or practical necessity for a construct such as the grammar of history or the grammar of mathematics." So they say, that, another quote, "The trivium is not a pedagogical method, but a collection of linguistic disciplines that incorporate a particular body of knowledge and whose study imparts a particular set of transferable learning skills." So, again, ACCS would actually disagree with that. We think it's both a pedagogical approach as well as a set of subjects. And so we can debate that. We don't need to divide over that. There's a lot in common and a lot of wisdom from Littlejohn and Evans. Another great book, again, published by ISI. This is another ISI book by a guy named Tracy Lee Simmons called Climbing Parnassus. I don't know a whole lot about Tracy Lee Simmons. I've heard him speak. I don't know if he's a Christian or not, but I think what he writes and what he says certainly comports and is consistent with classical education, if not Christian education. Roman Catholic. Yeah, that sounds right. Thanks. Extremely well written, very persuasive. He reviews the history of classical education and scholarships and makes a strong case for returning to not only Latin, but also Greek. Fairly challenging, but also extremely readable. I think it's a perfect book for boards to just understand what is it we're trying to do, what is it we're trying to recover. And the thing about Tracy Lee Simmons, he's very quotable. Certain books you read, Lewis is like this, I think Chesterton is like this, where you feel like you're highlighting every sentence. Climbing Parnassus was like that for me. He's just very well spoken, very well written, and very quotable. And one of the things I like about this book in particular is he talks about the value of hard work. And Climbing Parnassus. Parnassus is a series of mountain ranges in Athens. And if you've ever traveled, like on a grand tour trip or traveled to Athens, you'll see him. But he talks about, you know, the necessary ingredient of sweat and hard work and trial and learning. And a lot of times we want to, yes, there's a joy of learning, as Mortimer Adler said, there's a joy of learning, but there's also the pain of learning. And how do we balance that? That's a real tough task sometimes in schools, especially as our kids get older. Second grade, not too tough. 10th grade, 11th grade, those are harder years. You tend to see the pain and the hard work more. And I don't know, maybe it's just our school, but have you had that conversation? The joy of learning tends to fall a little bit as the kids get older, and so teaching them about hard work, Climbing Parnassus sort of addresses that. Okay, we're getting short on time, but I have just one or maybe two more books. Here's a couple of quotes, actually, from Tracy Lee Simmons. Much to be said for any curriculum that doesn't strive to give content so much as it does the tools and skill of judgment that allow us to get that content at our own leisure. And then this last quote, the hard, precipitous path of classical education ideally led not to knowledge alone, but to the cultivation of mind and spirit. Knowledge did not in and of itself justify the sweat. The climb was meant to transform one's intellectual and aesthetic nature as well. Isn't that great? I mean, he's very consistent with what we're hoping to do in our schools. The last official book on this list, and I've got a little bonus book if we have time, but this one's by Gene Veith and Andrew Kern, Classical Education, The Movement Sweeping America. The benefit of this, it's a short, very readable book, but what it helped me better understand is where ACCS, or Classical Christian Education, fits within the broader context of classical schools. So Kern and Veith talk about what they call Christian classicism, and those are these schools that we are working in. The ACCS schools take a trivium approach and really was founded on Doug Wilson's book, which we all have grown to appreciate. He also talks about democratic classicism, which was kind of a new term for me. These are schools that are founded more on a great books approach, the Mortimer Adler type of approach, virtues of good habits and right thinking, but not necessarily Christian. Maybe formed out of a Judeo-Christian understanding. So democratic classicism. They talk about moral classicism, which is the David Hicks view. They talk about liberating classicism, which you may have not heard of. Marva Collins. Does that ring a bell? You ever heard of Marva Collins? Marva Collins was someone who knew about classical education and wanted to take it to the inner city. And so Marva Collins, an African-American woman, said, hey, if this is the best education for the privileged, I'm going to take it to the underprivileged. And she actually did it. But, you know, she had an approach that was all business. And it was amazing what the 60 Minutes did a piece on Marva Collins. But it was amazing what she was able to do. It's not the student. It's the approach. And it's the belief. And it's the expectations that you have. And Marva Collins proved that. She has a book called Marva Collins Way that's kind of an interesting read. They talk about Catholic classicism, and then the homeschooling movement as well. So six different types approaches, the ACCS or classical Christian schools being one. We are almost out of time, but I'm going to add one more author. Actually, this is just one book by a guy named Richard Reason. This one's called Piety and Philosophy, A Primer for Christian Schools. Reason was more affiliated, I think, with ACSI schools, but he's written really great stuff. He wrote a book that's hard to find, but it's called School and Sports, A Christian Critique. So if you're wondering sort of about a sports program or what about a sports program that tends to take over the school, Reason has addressed that in his book, School and Sports, A Christian Critique. He also wrote a great book called The Academic Imperative, where he basically triumphs the liberal arts. He's an advocate for the liberal arts. So he's sort of a closet classicist, even though he was in more of the ACSI movement. So, boy, where to start? If you're a person that that is looking for where to start, hopefully you've got some ideas here, outlined some ideas. I would recommend, kind of going back to the beginning here, setting some reading goals. I don't know how often you read. I try to set a goal for myself, and once I have a goal in mind, it's amazing how you just kind of naturally try to hit that. So maybe it's a book a week, maybe it's a book a month, for whatever it is. Aim those goals. And I think if, as we model for our teachers and for our students what reading's about, hopefully we'll see sort of those ominous trends start to grow a little bit. So with that, let me. We're at 2:46. We started a little late. Maybe any points or questions, real quickly, before we are done. Yes. You know, shepherding a child's heart is one that we usually try to have our parents read, and then we try to give out the Doug Wilson Recovering Lost Tools. I also love I love the Case for Classical Christian Education even better. It's less, I don't want to say off-putting, but I think it's less offensive to people, the Case for Classical Christian Education, and Wilson's stuff I think is so readable. Any other questions or comments, or a book that you think is absolutely essential, maybe? The importance of architecture. Who's the author of that?
Brent Hull.
Brent Hull. H-U-L-L. Great. Great recommendation. Okay. Fantastic. Yeah. The question. Oh, is that Lee Borton? Or is that right? Okay. Great. Socratic teaching. Excellent. Is that Stephen Perks? Yeah, the Christian Philosophy of Christian Education Explained, Stephen Perks. Yep. Joseph Pieper, yeah. Leisure, the Basis of Culture. Excellent, thank you. Others? Yes. Sure. In fact, I'll give you my email, and feel free to email. I'd be happy to email a list that includes even more. So it's just my. Is it on there already? It's already in the book. Yeah, I'm not. I can recommend some, but I'm not a. I'm probably the wrong person to ask for biographies. Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, thank you so much for coming. We're already over time. Appreciate your attention. Thank you. Are you? Do you live in Washington now? Oh.